It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. The tomatoes are closing in. So are the peppers and the green beans. I have done it again. I have got bags and baskets of farmers market produce all over the kitchen. You know the drill. I mean, it all looks so great and the season is short. This is how you end up learning to can and preserve. The lucky part is there is a new nationwide movement to get all of us to put up the way our grandmothers did. And we've got the facts. We've also got a new take on Anthropology 101. A Harvard professor believes cooking is what made us human. All this and much more coming up on The Splendid Table.
This week's Splendid Table is a repeat of an earlier broadcast.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and is supported by Lundberg Family Farms, producer of organic rice and rice products, and by the Oregon Bounty Wonder Feast, featuring a new flavor each week. This week, it's artisan cheeses from Chev to Cheddar and back again. You can find more about Oregon cheesemaking at traveloregon.com. Now, for the next couple of weeks, great summer produce is going to be going for a few bucks, and then it's over. So it's time to cash in while you can. Stock up for the year. Yeah, I think you're going to need to join the latest trend. Apparently, canning and preserving are back big time, nationally. And food journalist Kim O'Donnell is here to tell us how to get in on the action. Kim, welcome.
Thank you so much.
So, Kim, how do we begin?
This is a really funny story. You know, when we think of the words canning and preserving, we think of old school, back with grandma.
Right.
Somewhere, you know, in the middle of nowhere. And this project that I've cooked up called Canning Across America got started on Twitter. So we're talking about a 21st century technological innovation way that people are communicating to revive the long-lost art of preserving, putting up food. And I had this brain, this sort of light bulb went on
right.
for me when I was chatting with my folks on Twitter and got inspired by a Bay Area canning project called Yes We Can. They're offering monthly canning classes in the Bay Area. I thought that was pretty nifty. And I put a link out there, said to people, you know, I live in Seattle, folks, I said, hey, Seattle, maybe we should copycat this idea. And I have, before that moment, I had only canned once in my life with two other canning virgins. So we were all sort of like blind leading the blind.
Yeah.
You know, we had Donna Summer playing on the stereo, if I remember correctly. I mean, it was great fun, but we were really like had the ball book in one hand and like the other hand on
the
funnel.
Yeah, the bull canning book, right, yeah.
Yeah. And so I really wanted to know if anyone else shared my curiosity. Certainly, I had seen all these other books that had been coming out. I mean,
mm-hmm.
there's been at least four books in the last year on preserving food,
right.
which is pretty incredible. Anyway, within an hour, people were emailing me from all over the country. Oh, my gosh, what are you thinking? And I said, well, what if we set a date? Or a series of dates where people in cities and towns across the country could be canning simultaneously. And, like, the thing that kept coming in my head was, like, hands across America.
Right.
You know, a show of cans, if you will.
Hold up your preserving jar.
Yes! And I thought, what the heck, right? And that's how this whole thing came to be.
So this is people canning together across the United States.
Yes. And we're really hoping that this is just the beginning. You know, we needed to set, you know, a couple of days that people felt like it was a kickoff.
Right.
So that they could get, you know, get their canning kettles fired up. And that we would continue the momentum through the growing season, which, as you know, in some places goes all the way up to the early part of November.
Mm-hmm.
So we are seeing, you know, here in Seattle, we've got the founding group, and there's lots of events going on at farmers markets and community centers and people holding their own parties. But we've got groups that have formed in Boston, and they're doing like a whole day of workshops, everything from the water bath to lacto-fermentation. And we've got a group in Freeport, Maine that's hosting a jamboree. And where else? New York, Chicago. But what's cool, Lynn, is that the business community is noticing. We, Jarden, the folks who make ball jars,
right,
they gave us 200 copies of the Blue Book to give away to readers.
How cool.
Yeah. Sur La Table just gave us an online discount for canning supplies. Yeah.
You have started a revolution.
Canvolution, friend.
I'm sorry, a canvolution. Hey, Kim, thank you.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Online food writer Kim O'Donnell's piece on instigating canning across America appeared on the Huffington Post site in August of 2009. Now, the one important thing that you need when canning is solid scientific information. Two books come to mind that you can lean on. One is called Putting Up by Stephen Dowdney, and the other is Well Preserved by Eugenia Bone. Now, for information on all this, just check out the website, splendidtable.com. And one more thought about putting up. At this very moment, travesty is happening to millions of tomatoes across America. Woefully misinformed folk are insulting this noble fruit by eviscerating the very heart of its deliciousness as they put it up for winter. Now, here is the crux of the whole issue, and I know I'm going to get mail on this. Never seed a tomato before you cook it. The seeds and their surrounding gel hold much of the tomato's flavor. Now, this is not just my idea, although I must confess I did think of it several years ago. But it comes out of research done by a British chef and science hound, Heston Blumenthal, and the food science faculty at England's Reading University. They found that higher levels of free amino acids, nucleotides, and other substances were in inner parts of unseeded tomatoes. Higher levels, by the way, as 3 to 10 times higher than in tomatoes that were seeded. Now, those substances, when you put them all together, are called umami. It's known as the fifth taste. Umami raises all boats. I mean, umami is remarkable because it increases the savoriness of the food that it's in and of everything else that food touches. So save yourself work and keep in all the flavor and leave in the seeds. Now, for a recipe that shines because of the seeds, check out my classic simmered Italian tomato sauce, which is good for canning and freezing. It's up on the website, splendidtable.org. You know the kind of place I look for when I'm traveling? Yeah, the fancy restaurant is fine, but the places I really love are the places where I can get good local food for next to no money. You know what I'm talking about. The Chicken Shack, the Tamale Place, the Hot Dog Stand. Now, Jane and Michael Stern call this sleeves-up eating. They report on their road food site and here. Hey, Jane, Michael, welcome.
Hey, Lynn.
Hi, Lynn.
Hi, I'm taking advantage of our friendship. I'm heading to L.A. Where should I go?
How about a place where you can get a cup of coffee for 9 cents?
You're kidding.
I'm not kidding. That's not why we love Felipe's in Los Angeles, but it's one of the things that makes it kind of a very special place.
Do you know the place we're talking about? It's called Felipe's the Original?
No, not at all.
Oh, my God. It is amazing.
They claim at Felipe's to have invented the French dip sandwich. You know, which is the beef on bread with a cup of au jus
right,
on the side.
Right.
And very often the bread itself gets kind of sopped in the gravy, too.
Yeah.
Genesis, according to Felipe the Original, happened in 1918 when Chef Felipe was preparing a beef sandwich. It was kind of at a cafeteria-style eatery, and the roll accidentally fell into his gravy. And he fetched it out with tongs, and it looked so good that the guy who had ordered it said, you know what, I'll take it just like that. And supposedly that was the first French dip sandwich.
I can taste it.
This place has been there forever.
Well, it moved. This particular location has been there since 1951. Felipe started in 1918. Today, it still has sawdust on the floors. And you eat at communal tables. It's kind of cafeteria style. You bring your own meal to the table. And, I mean, if you like people watching, let me tell you.
Not to brag, but one of the times Michael and I ate there, it's very popular with sequestered juries because it's right across from the courthouse. The O.J. Simpson jury was shepherded in there for their hot beef sandwiches and then shepherded back out by the marshals. But we were very impressed.
You didn't try to talk to them, right, or influence them in any way?
You know what I would have done, though, had I had a chance to talk to them, is influence them to veer away from the beef. I mean, beef is the classic.
Right.
But, you know, you can also get the French dip sandwich with the same beef gravy, but instead with sliced pork, which is even more tender than the beef, or, and I love this the most, sliced lamb, you know, which has that kind of sort of tangy zest to it that you don't get with the beef. Boy, is that good.
Weren't you like raving on about the hot mustard?
The mustard.
Yes,
that's the one. No matter what you get in your French dip, you must have Felipe's mustard. They make their own, and it is ferociously hot. And of course, you know, hot mustard and roast beef are such a great combination.
Now, one other thing, Lynn, one of the mysteries of the universe, coffee remains at 9 cents a cup, but decaf is 60 cents. Go figure.
They're doing the water process in the back of the place.
They must be.
But all right, but now wait a minute. If the coffee is 9 cents or 60 cents, how much are the sandwiches? Are they still 1951 prices?
No. You pay like maybe, I think, $7 or $8 for one of these sandwiches. Yes. I mean, the coffee is just kind of a novelty item.
And the atmo, meaning atmosphere, at this place is perfection.
We're going, guys. Thank you.
Okay. Lynn. Bye, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
Well, stick shifts and safety belts, bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving in the car. It makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of 500 Things to Eat Before It's Too Late. The Sterns come by every week, but you can get their food finds anytime you feel like it. Just check them out on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to also check out all of our other examples of vital, essential, life-changing information. Our newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, our Cheap Eats recipe collection, our podcasts, and information on our book, How to Eat Supper. Also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. It's all there at splendidtable.org. Coming up, we have news for Richard Leakey. You overlooked the true missing link. It's cooking that created the human animal. Well, I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is supported by Just Bare Chicken, all natural, with a simple commitment to natural food and respect for both animals and planet. Just Bare Chicken. Go minimal. You can learn more at justbarechicken.com. When we talk about man's evolution, we hear about the Stone Age and the Bronze Age, but we never hear about the Cooking Age. Now, much of science says our humanness was defined by the tools that we made, and that cooking evolved as a sort of sidelight. Well, Richard Wrangham strongly disagrees. He believes cooking is what shaped us physically and socially, literally what made us the human animal. Richard Wrangham is the Ruth Moore Professor of Biological Anthropology at Harvard, and he's director of the Kibali Chimpanzee Project in Uganda. He's written Catching Fire, How Cooking Made Us Human. Professor Wrangham, welcome.
Thanks so much. It's nice to be here.
Now,
for years and years, we've been told that tools are what separated us from the other animals. But you've gone against all of this research. Why?
Yes, I mean, for many years, it's both tools and meat-eating that people have thought has been the critical factors that elevated humans, as it were, from being apes into being humans. And what struck me is that nobody has paid attention to this amazingly important system of food processing, of cooking. And the reason it seems so fantastically important is that we all know that you are what you eat. And we all know that for animals, the search for food is absolutely critical. And what people have not paid attention to is the fact that there's a tremendous amount of evidence that when we cook, we get much more energy out of our food than if we eat it raw. And this is so important, I think, that the moment that one of our ancestors was able to do this, they were able to do many things that were previously not available. They could grow bigger bodies. They could use more energy for traveling about the environment. They could have babies faster. They could put more effort into protecting themselves from disease. And they could grow bigger brains.
But what's the science behind this? I mean, I thought that it was this idea that we could have a weapon and we could kill an animal, or we could have a knife and we could cut a plant, you know, and then eat it. I thought that was the key.
The science behind the importance of cooking comes from a review of a tremendously diverse nutritional literature. And what it says is that there are two big ways in which cooking gives us increased energy. One is that it increases the proportion of the nutrients in our food that we are able to digest. So if we eat raw wheat, then much of the starch that comes into our bodies is simply not available to us to be digested, and we pass it out uselessly. And the other thing it does, cooking does, is to reduce the amount of metabolic energy that our bodies expend in digesting the food. So if we cook our food, then we save maybe 10, 20, 30, we really don't know, the percentage of the amount of energy that we would ordinarily use to digest the food. And these two things between them mean that when we cook our food, we just get much more energy, much more calories, and then we can use it to change our biology.
So by looking at the remains of early man, could you tell whether or not those creatures at that time were cooking?
I think we can. We can't do it from the direct evidence because there isn't any direct evidence. That is to say, the record of the control of fire just decays slowly as we go back further in time to the point where you don't know whether its absence means that nobody was doing it or that it's simply the evidence has disappeared. But we have wonderful other ways of getting at this question. One of the discoveries that I made is that humans are incapable biologically of living effectively off raw food. That's because of those advantages that I mentioned of what cooking does to give us energy. And we have adapted to be able to use cooked food and not to use raw food. Well, what is it in our bodies that forces this adaptation? There are two obvious things that we can see in fossil species. One is small mouths and small teeth are associated with cooking, and the other is small guts. If we look at our stomach and our small intestine and our large intestine, they're about 60% of the size that they would be if we were a great ape. Well, we can go back in time and say, okay, when did our ancestors acquire these two features of small guts and small teeth, small mouths?
And the importance of the small mouths is that we didn't need to chew as much.
Absolutely right.
Okay.
If we were a great ape, we would spend 6 hours a day chewing our food.
Oh, my goodness.
And, of course, it wouldn't be like apples and oranges and bananas that have been domesticated by humans and made full of sugar and to be low in all of that fibrous stuff.
Right.
So you'd spend all day chewing it. So you need a big mouth and big teeth to do that. But once you cook, now you're eating high-density, high-quality food, and you can become this rather strange small-mouthed species of ape that we are. And it's clear when that happened. That happened just this side of 2 million years ago, about 1.9, 1.8 million years ago.
Am I making a leap here, saying that sharing food or cooking leads to socialization, leads to man being more engaged with fellow man?
Well, you are absolutely right in thinking that many people have followed that line of argument, because we nowadays always tend to think of a cooked meal as something very sociable. You know, if you're a hunter and gatherer, you're going through the bush and you eat some raw snacks, and that's just on your own. But you bring food back to camp and you cook it up and you sit around it, and this is a time for telling stories and for the family coming together and so on. And that carries on into modern life. But the question is why? What is responsible for that? And no one has ever really been quite sure. I've studied chimpanzees for most of my life, and one of the extraordinary contrasts that just hits me very clearly between chimpanzees and humans with regard to eating is that if you put some delicious food in front of a bunch of chimpanzees, they all fight over it. Whereas if you put a bunch of food, such as a cooked meal, in front of a bunch of hunters and gatherers, they're all incredibly courteous. And in my book, I do develop the idea, which seems to really work in terms of the animal behavior, that the reason that we are so social in our cooking is that not just that the food is attractive and people want to come and share it for that reason, but that the temptation to fight over the food has led to some very clear social rules. And those social rules, I think, lie at the heart of human society, the rules over the question of how to control conflict and competition and the temptation to pinch food from each other around the fire. And I think that, incidentally, this has been particularly fascinating in terms of gender relationships, because men could obviously steal from women because of their bigger size.
Right.
And very occasionally it happens, but it's very, very occasional indeed. And really what's happening here, I think, is that in all societies except modern urban societies, women invariably cook for men. And that seems to be part of an ancient sort of protection racket in which, as a result of women cooking for men, then they get men to protect their food from possible theft by other men.
Ha! Very clever system, isn't it?
Well, and it seems very fundamental to the way we are. I mean, once you start thinking about the importance of cooking, its supply of energy, its strange distribution compared to natural foods, then you think it has really, it's bound to have affected our evolution hugely, our behavior, our society, our cognition, all sorts of features about us.
Richard, thank you. A great deal to think about. Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Anthropologist Richard Wrangham is author of the book Catching Fire: How Cooking Made Us Human. Being humans, once we mastered the art of cooking, we began to make judgments about it. When food types pontificate on what makes a good cook, you get a fair amount of high-flown attributes like a trained palate, an understanding of food chemistry, knife techniques. People usually miss one key: stubbornness. Good cooks don't give up, and they don't quit, and they don't take the easy way out. Now, this is something food writer J.J. Good knows down to his fingertips.
My back aches. My eyes burn. I've been peeling and chopping for an hour, but I'm still being taunted by a pile of untouched vegetables. My problem is not the quantity. It's that the task of steadying each item falls to an almost useless appendage. The short, goofy arm, inexplicably bent into an L shape, and graced by just three fingers, that dangles from my right shoulder. No one knows why I was born like this. My mom wasn't exposed to any radiation while she was pregnant, nor did she, say, have one too many sips of wine. Yet I do occasionally wonder whether my dad's PhD dissertation subject, a pre-PETA endeavor for which he plucked the legs from frogs and studied their regeneration, sparked some sort of cosmic payback. Whatever the reason, I occupy a sort of upper middle class of the handicapped. Sure, there's plenty to complain about, but all in all, things aren't so bad. While the wheelchair-bound struggle to reach their stoves, it feels a bit Princess and the Pea of me to grumble that peeling potatoes is as grueling as making mole. or to lament that day last winter when my girlfriend took a trip to Philadelphia, leaving me at home in Brooklyn with a dozen oysters and not enough hands to shuck them with. Disability is relative. I'd rather be incapable of prying open shellfish than allergic to them. I happily live without most of the things I can't do. The kitchen, however, is where what I love butts up against what can be so discouragingly difficult. Forget shucking an oyster. Even a mundane task such as draining a pot of pasta can be death-defying. After swathing my right arm in towels to prevent it from searing, the last thing I need is for it to be less useful, I lodge it beneath the pot's handle with the same care I imagine a window washer uses to secure his harness to a skyscraper. Then I inch toward the sink, the whole time bracing for scalding disaster and indulging in an equally scalding torrent of self-pity. Some people say the kitchen is where they clear their heads. For me, it's where I face my demons. Every meal is a proving ground, and I suffer mistakes as though they were failures, even when they have nothing to do with my arm. It's really good, friends insist, as I sulk over hanger steak that doesn't have a perfectly rosy center, or a gratin whose top has barely browned, forever fighting the feeling that somehow it all would have gone right had I been born a little more symmetrical. I can even find fault with the faultless, because what I'm truly after is unreachable. Two normal arms. When I first started to cook, I developed a crush on any ingredient that leveled the playing field. I adored canned anchovies since the fillets simply melted in hot oil. I loved beets because after I roasted them in foil, their skins would slip right off. But soon my attraction to convenience gave way to a relishing of the arduous. Having previously avoided anything that required peeling, I now dove into recipes that called for celery root and butternut squash. I embraced Thai stir fries, which had me meticulously slicing raw pork into matching strips so they'd all finish cooking at the same time. I can't count the times friends have watched me tackle an overly complicated prep job, always girding themselves for a bloodbath, and anxiously urged me to try using a food processor. I appreciate the thought, I sniff, but I can handle it. This masochistic streak is why I'm still chopping. I'm having some friends over for dinner, and I'm making braised chicken, a dish that's a breeze for most cooks, but presents, for me, just the right level of hardship for a dinner party. The only way I can get what I casually call my right arm to act like one is to hunch awkwardly over my cutting board so it can reach the food that needs to be stabilized. For an hour, that was celery, onions, and carrots. A rough chop would surely suffice, but I'm attempting to dice, chasing the satisfaction of seeing perfect cubes conjured by a blur of hand and knife. My back is bent again. This time, I'm close enough to a chicken to kiss it, unfortunate no matter how comfortable you are with raw poultry. As I try to detach a leg, it slips from my right hand's feeble grasp, spattering my cheek with cold chicken liquid. I seethe but rinse off and continue. I could, of course, have bought chicken parts, but a whole chicken is always cheaper by the pound, and why shouldn't I have access? I like to think of the price discrepancy as a one-arm tax. Half an hour later, I've successfully dismantled the thing and begun the rewarding task of browning it, savoring the knowledge that any cook would, at this point in the process, be upright at the stove and wielding tongs in exactly the same manner as I am. After setting the chicken aside and spooning some of the golden fat from the pot, I take a seat, sweep the vegetables from my cutting board into a bowl supported by my knees, and ferry the bowl to the stove. The vegetables sizzle when I dump them in. Now to add the wine. The wine! I forgot I'd have to open a bottle, a potential catastrophe. I should turn off the burner just in case it takes as long to open this bottle as it did the last one. Instead, I bet my hard-won diced vegetables that I won't scorch them. Springing into action, I wedge the bottle between my thighs, wrap my right arm around the neck, its effect is almost purely symbolic, and struggle to work the screw through the cork. I already detect a faint acridity wafting from the pot, a whiff of defeat. I quickly adjust my technique, somehow wrenching the cork out in one piece, and rush back to the stove. The vegetables have more color than I wanted, but they're fine. In goes some wine, a few sprigs of thyme, and the chicken. I cover the pot and shove it into the oven. I know where there are more compelling examples of fortitude than me braising chicken. Like a paraplegic racing uphill in a tricked-out wheelchair on marathon day. Or my late grandfather, who at 90 walked down and up 20-odd flights in the pitch darkness of New York City's 2003 blackout to get groceries for his wife. But turn a spotlight on any accomplishment, however minor, and it seems like a triumph. Away from that glare, though, there's only the struggle. My right arm swathed again, my back contorted, I stoop down and heave the pot out of the oven without incident. I call in my friends, and we sit down to a dinner that I have to admit is pretty good. Someone even admires my fastidious touch, the precise little cubes of carrots and celery scattered beneath the burnished chicken. Thanks, I say. It was nothing.
Journalist J.J. Good writes about food and travel for national magazines. His article, Single-Handed Cooking, appeared in the July 2009 issue of Gourmet.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's late, but you call me. Tell me and I'll be around.
Time to turn to you and your questions. You can find us at 800-537-5252. Anything goes. Okay, let's see. We have got Andrew calling from Chapel Hill. Hey, Andrew, what do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about potatoes, Lynn. My question is to DI or not to DI?
Very good question. Okay. I always remove the eyes. And the reason is, first of all, I don't like biting into them. I mean, right. It comes down to that. From what I understand, there's nothing harmful about the eyes. Was this a debate between you and someone else?
Well, honestly, it's sort of this unspoken family debate. My mom grew up where they always de-eyed potatoes, always de-eyed. So if I'm cooking with my mom, de-eyed potatoes.
Okay.
Or I may have it switched, but anyway, one parent or the other, one was for de-eyeing, the other one was for not de-eyeing, and it was pretty strict.
In my family, by the way, it was polenta. Should it be coarse ground or fine ground? And did you stir it from left to right or right to left? So I understand
exactly.
These things, yes. Okay, it is solely a matter of taste, but generally you remove the eyes because they don't taste all that good.
Okay.
But there is one thing about the eyes that you should know. As the potato ages, it throws out, essentially, new roots, new sprouts. And
right.
Those eyes are the beginning of those sprouts. Now, when those eyes are really well developed, a lot of the starch and sugar and flavor of the potato has gone into those eyes. So don't buy potatoes where the eyes are really well developed.
Okay.
When there's just a little bit of it, it's not a big deal. But it's just that you're not going to get a lot of flavor out of it. But I vote for whatever side of the family removes them.
Okay.
Thanks for a great question. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Well, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, it's about the Beatles, and it's not in the latest releases. What kind of apple was used as the symbol for the Beatles Apple Records label? Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we'll be taking more of your calls. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is supported by Lundberg Family Farms, grower of organic and eco-farmed rice and producer of gluten-free rice products. Since 1937, dedicated to caring for the land responsibly and sustainably. More at Lundberg.com. Now, we're going to be back to you in a moment. You can join us at 800-537-5252 or get to us on Facebook. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what kind of apple was used as the symbol for the Beatles' Apple record label? Well, the answer is the Granny Smith. Now, for trivia that you can actually use, here's how to store apples for a month or more. Now, this is just in time for apple season. To keep apples, you've got to do three things. Number one, you've got to cut off their oxygen. Number two, you have to keep them moist. And number three, you got to keep them cold. Now, you should know that apples can actually breathe. They take in oxygen and they give off carbon dioxide, just the way we do. Now, if you slow down or stop that process, you can slow down their deterioration. Now, one way to keep apples in their prime is to put them in a plastic bag, sprinkle them with some water, punch a couple of holes in the bag, and then put them in the coldest part of the refrigerator, kind of between 30 and 40 degrees. Now, they'll keep for a month or two that way. Of course, if you want to keep apples for up to 9 months, you could do what commercial growers do. They put them in a cold room filled with nitrogen gas. Maybe something to consider when you're redoing the kitchen. Okay, back to your calls. Let's talk. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. We have got Mary Kate on the line calling from Portland, Oregon. Mary Kate, what do you want to talk about?
On my honeymoon to Australia with my husband, we went to a fabulous mall called the Queen Victoria Mall.
Where were you again on your honeymoon?
In Sydney.
Oh, Australia.
Australia.
Oh, okay.
And we had these really great savory muffins, feta and spinach, sort of gooey, wonderful muffins, almost like a bread quiche.
Ooh.
And I've never seen them anywhere else.
Yeah. I'm not sure about texture, but I can tell you, you can take any basic muffin recipe, and I would go for a good one. You know what I'm saying? I would go to Dory Greenspan or Shirley Currier or Rose Levy Berenbaum or The Joy of Cooking. And you can add whatever you wish. All right, just to explain, a basic muffin recipe is probably something like a couple of cups of flour, some kind of leavening, baking powder, you know, that kind of thing, salt. A little bit of sugar, and you always want a little bit of sugar. Never eliminate all of it because it helps browning with the muffin. Okay? And then you mix, always with a muffin recipe, you mix the dry ingredients together, and then you have the moist ingredients, which is usually eggs, milk, or some kind of dairy. Okay? And melted fat. So it could be oil, it could be melted butter.
Okay.
And you mix all of the liquid ingredients very well. And when you stir them together, you leave the mixture lumpy. You never, ever mix it until it's smooth. And then you put it into a muffin tin and you bake it. That's it. Now, generally, most recipes have about 2 cups of flour. Okay? It's more or less standard.
Okay.
What I've learned from what I've done, because I've done fresh herbs and cheeses or leftover, you know, interesting vegetables, you know, stuff that I've made like a little stew of cabbage and tomato and whatever. Well, when I take some of that leftover, I chop it up fine and I put that in my muffin blend. For 2 cup of flour recipe, you can add 3/4 cup or a teeny bit more of any kind of stuff you want. So if you were to do the feta and cook spinach, you want to squeeze it pretty dry because you don't want it to be soppy, and maybe substitute a little bit of cream for maybe the milk called for in the recipe, you get where you're going to get something richer, right?
Right.
You could end up with something very close to what you had.
Wow, we thought we'd have to go back to Australia for these. We had never seen them in Portland.
I think a trip to Australia would be a great idea to taste them again, but I would suggest take a basic muffin recipe and start fooling around.
Clearly the plan. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Mary Kate.
Thanks so much.
You take care.
You too.
Bye. 800-537-5252. Or send us an email at splendidtable.org. We got an email, by the way, from Mackie in New Orleans, and Mackie wanted to know about brown sugar. Said that, "I've read that brown sugar is really white sugar that's been colored with molasses. Is this true? And isn't it much better to use raw sugar whenever so-called brown sugar is called for?" Well, essentially, this is the deal. You're right. It is sugar that's been colored with molasses. And it used to be that things that were called demerara or turbinado sugar, which were brown, were really sugars that were only partially processed. So all the molasses wasn't removed, because when you process sugar, what happens is you get molasses. It's extracted. Sugar crystals are left. Those crystals are dried, and that's how we get white sugar. So here's the deal, though. Lamentably, most things that are labeled raw sugar are simply white sugar crystals with the molasses added back. Is it healthier? I don't know. But, I mean, if you start out with something like, you know, organic molasses, that has probably more nutrition in it than processed sugar does. So if you want to use brown sugar, it's all going to be colored with that molasses. Thanks for the email. And remember, everybody, you can reach us at splendidtable.org or 800-537-5252. We have Mark calling from St. Paul. Mark, what do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about fresh-made pasta, Lynn. I'm having a great time. I'm making my own. And as long as I'm dropping it in the water and cooking it for my friends,
right,
no problems.
Wait, Mark, your voice is very familiar.
Yes, it is.
Why is that?
Well, I kind of work on the third floor.
All right.
You're always rushing to and fro, and I never get to speak to you for very
so
long.
So you called the show.
I called the show.
Folks, this is my colleague, Mark. You should know. Okay, so Mark's calling from the third floor, and I'm on the fourth floor. Okay, but now go on. You're saying go on about the pasta, though. This is interesting.
Okay, I'm having a great time. I'm making my own pasta
right
by hand. I've got my little pasta, you know, press and
right
cranking it out. And as long as I'm cooking it fresh, it's perfect. I can't believe I waited 42 years to make my own fresh pasta.
Yeah.
But where I'm getting into trouble is trying to extend the shelf life, because I should not eat an entire batch of pasta by myself.
It's so easy, though, isn't it, when it's that good?
Oh, my God, it
so,
is.
So what's happening to the pasta?
Okay, well, ravioli, piece of cake. I put it on parchment paper, I freeze it,
right,
and I'm good.
Mm-hmm.
The problem that I had is I was making a spaghetti and angel hair pasta, and what's happening is that it's kind of sticking together. I tried drying it on the back of my dining room chairs with mm-hmm tea towels, and that was a disaster. It was like a pasta factory
yeah
exploded all over my dining room floor.
The tea towels never were the same again.
So what am I doing wrong?
Well, first of all, this is what broomsticks were created for. You want to clean off a couple of long-handled anythings, broomsticks or whatever, and you put them between those chairs.
Okay.
Right? Put some newspaper underneath them.
Right.
Secondly, when you make your dough, knead it a lot. You want it so elastic.
Okay,
that it's not going to be super fragile. Do you do what you do a dough with egg in it?
I do. It's just egg and flour. That's all
right
it is.
Now you have to understand something, that generally doing the doughs we generally do for handmade pasta, this makes a pasta that's more brittle than the pasta we buy in the box, because there's a different flour that's used. It's a much higher protein flour. That's not better or worse. It's just different. And pasta can be fresh pasta can be made ahead.
Mm-hmm.
So when you do the pasta, make sure you first of all have kneaded that dough for a good 10 minutes if you're working by hand. If you're doing it in a food processor, you turn it on and off. You don't want the dough to get hot. But you want to really have that dough so elastic that when you stretch it, it goes right back.
Okay, great.
Now, once you've done that, you can give the dough a rest for about a half hour, and then you can use your pasta machine, or if you want, you can roll it out by hand.
Okay.
Which will give it even better tooth for grabbing onto the
mm-hmm
sauce. But you want to get it so thin that you could almost read a newspaper through it.
I see.
But before you cut it, all right, before
uh-huh
you cut it in any way, you want to let it dry just the slightest bit until it's almost a little leathery. It's still totally pliable, but it's not damp.
OK. Okay.
Okay? And this means you just spread out those sheets, whether you've done them by machine or by hand, over, you know, a flowered area. It can be your countertops or whatever. Don't overlap them.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right? Because they'll get sticky. Now you cut the pasta however you wish to cut it, and it'll hold together better. But what you do is you never let the pieces touch. You spread them out on those handles.
Uh-huh.
Okay? And you just don't let them overlap or touch, and just let them dry. Now, you can use them right away, or you can use them the next day, or you can use them 2 days from now.
Sure.
But they will get a bit brittle, so handle them carefully.
Okay.
And by the way, just as an aside, if you ever decide you want to spend $20 on 1 pound of box pasta, there's an example of how fragile and yet how fabulous your pasta can be. The Cipriani people from the famous hotel and bar and whatever in Venice do a box pasta, and it is these thin, thin, thin ribbons of fettuccine wrapped in paper because they're that fragile.
Wow.
So you are on the – I mean, if it's fragile, there's nothing wrong with it.
Right.
It is just that it is made with a more – it's a more delicate style of pasta.
Excellent.
So that's what you do.
Great.
And now you can – have an excuse for not eating it, and I dare you to try.
All right. Thanks a lot, Lynn.
And see you in the mailroom.
All right. Sounds good.
Bye.
Bye.
Call us from the third floor, the second floor, or wherever you live. 800-537-5252. Now, if you define eating as putting something in your mouth and swallowing it, then the following bit of research qualifies for a place on a food show. The research was done in England by the Department of Radiology at the Gloucestershire Royal National Health Service Foundation Trust. We have Dr. Brian Whitcomb of the Radiology Department on the phone. Dr. Whitcomb, welcome.
It's good to be with you.
So, Dr. Whitcomb, could you tell us what this research was?
I was sent an X-ray of a sword swallow, and I'm a radiologist, so I was rather intrigued by one or two points, wondering, A, whether the sword went through to the stomach, and secondly, the throat looked very displaced relative to the spine on the X-ray. So I got a bit curious, and I searched the English language medical literature and found only three reports of sword swallowing. Two were by ear, nose, and throat surgeons explaining how it was done in one individual, and there was one Texan who'd ruptured his esophagus sword swallowing. So there were only these three papers in the whole of the English language medical literature. When I Googled it, there was masses of information.
Uh-huh.
Well, at least alleged information. And the whole issue raised the sort of questions that might spring to your mind. You know, how do they learn? How do they do it? Do they get injured? Do they get it through to the stomach? And so on.
And why, in heaven's name, when you think about it, would anyone continue to swallow swords?
Well, the one question I wasn't able to answer was the why. But it does take a substantial amount of time to learn. But that's how I got into it. And I wrote a little article in the BMJ called Sword Swallowing Uncertainties, because I couldn't answer some of the questions.
Is that the British Medical Journal?
That's right.
Uh-huh.
And while I was doing that bit of research, I made contact with Dan Mayer in Alabama, who's a sword swallower. I got a very effusive response, and over a period of time, we developed an email relationship. And then he had an injury, and he emailed me with extraordinary email. He said, I had five swords inside me, making a video for the Dave Letterman show when the macaw on my shoulder misbehaved, and turned my head, and I got a severe pain in the lower chest.
Oh, my Lord.
And also, it transpired, he very diligently kept an amazing database of 110 sword swallowers in 16 countries. So we surveyed the sword swallowers. We got 46 respondents, and we got a great deal of information from them. So it was that's how I got into it in a rather strange way.
But the other thing that's interesting is that really this must have a great deal of craft involved, that you don't generally get injured doing it. Otherwise, people wouldn't be able to continue.
Absolutely. I think the thing that impressed me was how the vast majority of them very diligently had practiced over weeks and months and years to develop the skill. And they learned in a bizarre number of ways. So there was a sequence of learning skills that they developed over really quite a protracted period of time, most of them.
I feel duty-bound at this moment to say this is not something to try on your own at all. But is there any value here for the rest of the population, that now that you have this information?
Well, I think that it's certainly interesting to compare both the injuries and what they're doing with a clinical endoscopy, where clearly medics are putting an endoscope through into the stomach.
Yeah.
And some of the complications are comparable. I'm not sure there's a lot to learn. One of the difficulties was the ethical one of actually studying sword swallows, because you can't just X-ray them. So one's really just taking the history and their story and analyzing it, yeah, rather than being able to do anything invasive. One surgeon has measured the esophageal pressures in a sword swallow and shown that the sword swallow is able to relax the muscles in a way that is not usual. But I'm not sure, apart from the complication rate and the curiosity value, that we learned a lot medically from it, except it was interesting to compare with the endoscopy.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Not at all. Pleasure.
Take care. Dr. Brian Whitcomb worked on his sword swallowing research at the Department of Radiology at Gloucestershire Royal National Health Service Trust. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. We're going to meet up next week, but until then, let me leave you with this thought from Somerset Maugham. He said, "At a dinner party, one should eat wisely, but not too well, and talk well, but not too wisely." The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and supported by Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. You can meet people who love food at food.gather.com. You'll find information on nearly everything you heard here today on our website, splendidtable.org. And also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Judy Boudreau. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Brett Baldwin. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. We're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.